Shall we continue? The cassette, Audio's Stepchild. This was prepared jointly with Del Eilers, who had hoped to be here and share in its presentation. 3M has other plans for him, as I just discussed, so today I'm functioning as myself, and though we may all shudder at the thought, he particularly, as a virtual Del. The cassette has long been the stepchild of the sound recording and preservation world, exceeded only by the 8-track. The format we all love to hate, and not without reason. Yet the audio press has been strangely silent on the defects of this system, perhaps a reflection of the sensitivity of some advertisers to adverse comment in the editorial matter. But fear not, your indefatigable researcher has found an anguished account of cassette cause problems in a most obscure corner of the technical periodical press. That was the preceding letter. My inquiry deals with the problem I have with cassette tapes. It seems that the tapes that are fairly old, 2 to 3 years, or that I rarely play, produce a high squeal when played on any stereo equipment, car stereos and or home stereos. Reducing the treble on my equalizer does not stop the problem. I am wondering if there is anything I can do, short of buying new tapes, to stop the noise. The answer is your problem with the older tapes in your collection is a common one. This is 1986. And unfortunately, there is probably nothing that can be done to solve it. From your description, the squeal sounds as if, as if it is a property of the tape mechanism itself, since it occurs on any equipment on which the tapes are played. We've come a long way. Even though this is extremely irritating, it will not affect the sound of reproduction. That's also not true. The hubs on older tapes will often squeal because of age or because of the graphite slip sheets have become worn. Unfortunately, any attempt to lubricate the hubs will permanently damage the tape itself. The tapes that you purchase now should not give you this problem, even after years of use. In an effort to eliminate the squeal problem, the tape mechanism currently manufactured is of much higher quality. Perfect sound forever again. The other question, which may involve some other ethical problems concerning audio, I leave to your imagination for the moment. Since the recorders and playback devices on which the cassette works are often small, highly portable, and used in a casual manner, cassettes are frequently moved about from indoors to outdoors and back again from one temperature and humidity environment to another without a second thought. It is important to remember that tape's biggest enemies are great humidity and rapid shifts in temperature. The casual disdain with which we usually treat inexpensive throwaway products comes home to roost when we suddenly discover cassettes may contain valuable sound information. Even those of us who handle the big reels with the care afforded to donor organs treat cassettes as if they are fingernail parings and from a lesser species at that. The cassette is used in many ways, some less obvious than others. Some applications now use other recording media. But here is a rundown of some of the uses of the cassette, either present or past. It is quite usual for many performers who first seek recording contracts to make demos either at home on inexpensive equipment or in a local recording studio. The customary method of distribution to A&R departments has been cassettes, which replaced acetate discs, though today it is mixed with CDR submissions. Cassettes have been and are still used for copyright deposit copies of musical compositions, especially since changes to the copyright laws allow recordings in lieu of sheet music. An enormous number of submissions work their way into the Library of Congress's sorting system. They have an elaborate set of rules of options when deciding what to retain and how to document them. During the commercial recording process, particularly of popular music, Cassette copies of the rough mixes were made for the musicians involved to take home and try out, often just overnight. Many of these evolutionary stages survive and are of considerable historical interest. Archivists picking through a musician's collection should be on the lookout for these. The battery-operated cassette recorder has been a useful ethnomusicological tool for those collecting folk materials without the funds for the Nagra reel-to-reel recorder. But beware of sand in the cassettes. In recent years, there has been a trend toward using video recorders with built-in sound capabilities, but there are still scares of audio cassette field recordings out there. Fading battery life can cause restoration problems later. Commercial pre-recorded tapes for use in car and Walkman are a popular product. Because looking will not disclose if portions have been damaged or erased, there is considerable resistance to accepting them as legitimate collectible objects as a category. But there are some few items whose only edition is in this format, or worse, 8-track. There is a Sinatra reprise issue, which, as I recall, falls into this group. I've noticed large numbers of cassettes in older people's LP collections, particularly recent acquisitions, both commercial and homemade from discs or radio broadcasts. They have been a boon to those with failing eyesight or an unsteady hand and a continuing urge for music. Orchestras, and sometimes art galleries, create pre-concert or exhibit talks for the benefit of their audiences. The speaker may be a scholar of note, use interesting musical examples, and so forth. Concert tapes are often made for limited distribution by local bands, folk groups, etc., to be sold at the club door. They may contain music or versions of songs which differ from the same musician's commercial offerings and often predate them, should there have been any. Even established bands record from a mixing board, including masters made of rock concerts, copies from which are later distributed to fans openly, the Grateful Dead, or clandestinely. I have a few myself. I suspect we all make copies at home of commercial records and other recordings, broadcast concerts, and so forth, to play in the car. I hate CDs in the car. When I can hear the soft parts adequately, the climaxes are far too loud. I prefer the more limited dynamic range of the cassette for this use, and the emergency vehicle's characteristic noises are not covered by my in-car audio system with cassettes. We also use them to reorder a program sequence. When you obtain your second PhD, you can do this with a CD changer, but I prefer the ability to assemble my own program on cassette anyhow. In this case, to heck with copyright. I bought the product and I feel under no obligation to accept the sequence of selections the recording company imposed on me. Music appreciation texts are usually accompanied by a set of tapes nowadays. Often instructors put their own examples together to be used in music education settings. There is a tough copyright issue here, as using a complete piece, even for educational purposes, is not fair use. Suzanne Stover has addressed this in her legal dialogues in the pages of the Ars Journal. Dancers, poets who use background music, and other performance artists learn their latest creations to a specific performance of a specific piece or pieces, usually copied from a record. The cassette allows repeated playing time to an index point on the player's counter. These have proven invaluable documents to trace otherwise ephemeral artistic events, even if incompletely. The Museum of Modern Art is among those with a significant quantity of these. Oral history with sung or played examples by the informant is another wide use of the cassette. This is particularly helpful in the music field, recollections of orators, or other instances where rhythm and vocal inflection is important. Spoken word. Oral history is the first use which comes to mind. Here, the cassette has been a blessing. Tape correspondence is another way the medium is used. People make home recordings of sports events and so forth from radio and TV. Without the cassette, the practical answering machine would have had to wait until the digital storage chip was developed. How would our civilization have been different if this had been deferred 15 or so years? Would this delay have accelerated or slowed the decline and fall? Enough philosophy. However, the ease with which a phone conversation can be recorded using the same device has led to some legal and ethical questions which still trouble our courts. Education. There are large catalogs of educational cassettes, some to be used alone, some to be integrated with printed and visual teaching materials with similar uses in business training and in self-motivation courses. And of course, the cassette has become ubiquitous in the lecture hall as a supplement to note-taking or as a device to cover you when you're taking your nap. Recordings for the blind. Many of these are distributed on audio cassette. They may be useful for pleasure listening, even by sighted folks. Though the readers are volunteers, I know of an active one sitting in our audience today, there are times when the readers are the author, which may give the recordings archival interest. The whole area of talking books on cassette is one most collectors have yet to explore. Communications. Public service announcements used to be distributed this way. I have some Stan Freberg stuff in this format. Copies have long been made by the general public from radio or TV, going back to the RCA home recording discs of the earliest 30s. A more recent twist, I believe during the 1960s, has been for broadcasters themselves to sell shows previously aired to the general public, or at least the audio from them. The distributed cassette often will prove the earliest generation copy to survive long term, especially as the dat from which the station now often makes its copies begin to fail. This will lead to the same absurd situation which is often encountered in the archives of performing organizations. Making copies of their concerts or broadcasts and exchanging or selling copies of them is considered illegal by them and is discouraged until the organization needs something for its own archive and find these collectors are the only community which has what it wants. Religious and inspirational. The cassette is used to record services through the church's PA systems, to record talks and classes by religious leaders. Given the large number of agonized inquiries I get on this topic, whenever there is serious flooding or other natural disasters in the US, there must be thousands of these archives, some of them extremely large. Basements of churches also usually hold collections of reminiscences by early members, a significant oral history accumulation countrywide. These often are the fruits of family interviews regarding genealogy. Church basements, local historical societies, and public libraries are a natural magnet for such collections. Business. It is usual to record dictation on cassettes which can be played back in real time, starting and stopping where the typist needs time to get it all down. There are many machines dedicated to this function which offer an option of keeping the pitch but slowing down the words. This trick is used in advertising as well to fit a spot announcement or commercial into a specific time. Sound from even accidentally preserved routine dictation tapes may be of later interest if the speaker becomes a major corporate figure. They are used to record board meetings for the record. Even when a secretary is taking notes, the tape can be consulted to clarify a point. We have an extensive accumulation in our own archives. Also used to record and distribute convention and conference proceedings. ARSC has an extensive catalog of these programs on cassette from previous meetings. The AES runs simultaneous sessions, and I often buy tapes for those I cannot attend. Politics. We'll skip this one for now. There's no end to it. Law enforcement. Though the 911 system uses very slow-speed reel-to-reel recorders, there are many instances where telephone conversations, undercover espionage, eavesdropping, people carrying recorders as well as microphones, all have had their fruits preserved on the audio cassette. In most cases, however, newer devices using similar technologies have replaced it. Medical. There are many uses within the medical profession. It is used for oral description during autopsies, operations, a mic over the work table going to a recording system. The National Library of Medicine has a great big collection. The list is by no means complete. I've mentioned the preceding uses only to show how, in the last 30 years, how very strongly and stealthily the audio cassette has permeated every fissure of our culture, and how hazily we may be aware of its omnivorous presence. Many of us in this room are concerned with the cassette as applied to music. Legitimately, the cassette is here considered the carrier of last resort. The same sound of equal generation in any other format is preferable, except for the 8-track. But for many of the applications I've just mentioned, the cassette is as good as it gets. And from both a technical quality and cost-related standpoint, there is little reason for it to have been better. The only reason for upgrading the original sound carrier would have been to increase its archival lifespan. Most of what we know about this problem is relatively recently acquired knowledge. The original users of this equipment cannot be faulted for doing things with an inexpensive system, which now proves vulnerable, where often the only other financially responsible option was not to record anything at all. The cassette is used in many unusual places. And these, the environmental aspects of the use of the cassette have some bearing on its lifetime, as you may inkle. There are players designed to be used in the kitchen, though not for media survival there. Even the soundtrack for Grease will succumb to a well-directed spatter. And even were the player kitchen-proof, where the tapes go, which are about to be played or which have just finished? Why, on that nice clean counter, of course. They're used in the car and when jogging. And remember, when parked, the car is a closed space heated by direct sunlight. This creates dimensional change in the cassette shell, which differs among its parts. The tape path is altered accordingly. Not only does the tape expand, but the heat speeds up molecular action. Print through is encouraged. The rapid cooling from putting the air conditioning on induces temperature shock, with its consequence, rapid change in the dimensions of all parts of the sound system, not just the cassette. Opening and closing the car doors and drying out the air within the vehicle during a protracted rainy weather by running the car's HVAC system changes the humidity rapidly, more instant atmospheric instability. Playing tapes while running to the cleaners, the market, the ball field, and the rest of the Saturday errands, this continuous heating and cooling cycle creates a considerable amount of debris inside the cartridge as well as within the player. Debris which, when dampened, sticks to the heads and other surfaces over which the tape passes, considerably more than in the more environmentally stable home settings. The Walkman, miniature bundled inside a boombox, has its own problems when used in humid weather. All the above assumes the playback equipment is properly shock mounted to avoid mistracking over road bumps, the bounce caused by jogging, and so forth. Car and portable cassette players must be cleaned often. Otherwise, the tape gets caught within the mechanism, creating one of the enduring snapshots of the 70s and 80s, a stream of tape from a discarded cassette in the roadway rippling in the breeze. Given the demands we make on this fragile medium, I think it quite remarkable the devices perform as well as they do for as long as they do. Now, a lot of casual recording is done through internal machine-mounted microphones, though sometimes cheap plug-in units are set on a table. People put mics where they pick up noise from the transport mechanism. Grind, grind. When considering, it is unrealistic to expect that most of them have any real understanding of the recording arts. Don't blame them. All you can do at the preservation end is get the best result from what they made for you. Now, this is a change in our do no harm philosophy. Here, it is often necessary to make subjective rather than objective copies, altering sonic values to get something comprehensible, reducing hums and hisses and so forth. This is a judgment play, but we're dealing here with a very sick patient to begin with, as a rule. Putting the signal on, there are many instances where the cassette is the original recording and subsequent copies are bumped up to a loftier format for editing, reel-to-reel, for example. I wonder how many bootleg silver discs ultimately derive from an audio cassette. Anyone remember the old advertising slogan, "Beware the blunted needle"? How about turntable rumble? How about cleaning and centering the record first? Why should tapes made from records be considered archival objects anyhow? Well, there are exceptions, particularly in the preservation of performance art materials. Otherwise, I think you'd need a pretty good reason not to throw them out. Commercial tapes are, well, why bother recopying this stuff? But there is one segment of commercial tapes where preservation may be essential. there's an enormous portion of the third world where bus stop and roadside copying stands are the local record store. Most of these are tropical or nearly so. Often you are not buying from a purchased inventory, but choose your desired program from the tapes the vendor carries and have it dubbed while you wait, or buy from his just-made stack. Most folk archives are overflowing with local and regional music brought back by researchers, which can only be obtained this way. In audio, we have a principle of saving things by the earliest generation. This reduces the noise and distortion buildup which accumulates from one recording generation to the next. We had a little demonstration of that yesterday afternoon. If the original is the cassette, that is where to begin. What are the symptoms of sick tape? Well, first of all, if it sounds different than the last time you heard it, if it smells funny, if you are hearing dropout, if it sheds either dry powder or a sticky substance. The former says it's time. The latter not only has the tape turned bad, but that you had better clean every surface it just went over before playing the next one. If it works and fits and starts, if it squeals, if it won't work at all, now there's a good sign. If the playback machine makes noises it doesn't make on other tapes, if the meters go crazy, if after cleaning you play the tape, clean again, and your Q-tip comes away discolored, and we had one of those passed around this morning. Some of these may have other causes as well, but if these symptoms occur and the tape is old enough, it's time to focus on preservation activities. Sooner or later, there will be a digital program where a signal which wanders in pitch will be corrected automatically. Hum can be removed or sharply reduced. I've just been working on spoken material where the ground line to the mic keeps coming loose, just touching the ground by a strand, making full contact, etc. And the hum is often louder than the recording. It's now fixable. Other digital wonders will be described and demonstrated by other or others, depending on whether DART has shown up or not, later in this session. As with any other recorded format, it is essential that the item be played back as closely as possible to how it was recorded. Head alignment, Dolby or non-Dolby, etc. I would call this the first law of audio restoration. It's still time-consuming to determine and replicate the original recording device's settings from at the instant that the recording was made. Well, then, what is worth the effort and preservation cost when a collection is found in this format? I've discussed this in general terms at this conference last year and in a booklet, Preservation Appraisal of Sound Recordings Collections, which I also gave away last year. I have some with me, and if I run out, I'll leave them up here. If I run out, I'll be glad to mail you one. Problems in the system. Interchange. Some cassettes made on one machine sound poorly or may have problems functioning on other machines. Hardware manufacturer. Cassette recorders. Many are made very cheaply. Head alignment and shock mounting can be off, even when new. For most of these ills, there are no easily adjustable, accessible settings, never mind knowing how to adjust them and on a regular schedule. As these toys get bounced around, original factory tweaks may shift. Tape equalization settings are frequently not changeable or are set inaccurately at the factory. There is little chance to change equalization without total disassembly, especially with inexpensive models, which may even lack switches to discriminate among tape types. The Dolby and DBX systems for the audio cassette are designed to compress the signal at different rates at different frequencies and to reverse the process in playback. It's a clever way of overcoming some of the deficiencies of the narrow track width and slow speed limitations imposed by the cassette format. On inexpensive players, Dolby B and C are on chips, not user adjustable. If you have made a Dolby tape and it sounds the same in playback, when you switch this section on and off, it's not working. Beware, a recording made at 1.5 IPS will sound in pitch on the machine on which it was made if that is also the speed at which, as is invariably the case, it plays back. On a machine running at the established standard speed, 1 7/8, it will sound very, very flat. If the power source is the wall outlet in the US, the power stream will be steady and it is closely monitored by the electricity supplier. If the speed is correct at the beginning, it will be so at the end as well, provided there is sufficient motor torque to keep the tape moving evenly. Some, however, are underpowered. Some speed problems are caused by debris in the path which that debris grabs the tape. Don't blame the motor for this one. Remember that the guts of a cassette are really a miniaturized version of those reels sitting on the top plate of a commercial reel-to-reel machine, closed into a box and operating behind a closed door. This by no means implies there are no user-accessible parts behind that door. A cleaning regime is essential to cassette good health, as with any mechanical device. Clean regularly, more frequently even than reel-to-reel, as everything is miniaturized in relation to the size of the average dust mote. See the instruction book that came with your machine, provided one did and you still have it. Battery-operated devices work fine for a while, but then, at the least opportune time, carry extra batteries. Cassettes will slow down while playing or recording when batteries near exhaustion. It is essential that tape heads be aligned 90 degrees vertical and 0 degrees horizontal. There are test tapes made for this purpose. Get them. Learn how to use them or have them on site for your technician's use. Don't count on him bringing them over himself. Demagnetize your heads before using these test tapes, and don't loan these tapes out ever. Any magnetic changes to these tapes, and you have corrupted and destroyed your calibration tool. If this happens, replace those tapes and throw the old ones away. Don't even leave yourself a chance to make the mistake. So if you're faced with an old cassette and want the best sound out of it, is there any way of telling if and how badly out of alignment the original recording machine may have been when the tape was made on it many years ago? Sonic problems which might indicate alignment difficulties may also be caused by other factors, either alone or more usually in combination. The way most inexpensive machines are designed, there is usually little slack in adjustment for adjustment tool space to get in around the heads. Besides, they're covered up by the cassette shell while the tape is playing back. You can't adjust things while the tape is playing, except Nakamichi. The DR1 and its predecessors, including the Dragon, which is the granddaddy of them, the 700 and its whole family. The DR1 is made presently. The other 10 or so models recede into the 70s. They're the only cassette machines known to me where the head position can be adjusted during playback, though others may do so when preparing to record. It reads the top track and the bottom of the second track, and by means of a knob, the user tilts the head until the high frequency output from both is equal. On the Dragon, the head was mounted on a platform moved by a small motor. It performed this function automatically. It also broke a whole lot. On others, two red lights would blink evenly when alignment was obtained. I am told that on the DR1, the knob is turned, you listen, and when you think the high frequency output is the same, you stop. I'm expecting one of these types of machines in shortly, and so check with me later for further details. Many of the models Nakamichi made are long out of print. The DR1 lists at about $930. Others in this family sold for substantially more when new, but can sometimes be found at lower prices even than the DR1 when they're used. There's only one problem. As with all other older equipment, getting parts can be terribly difficult. The designs are fairly intricate and may use 4 or 5 belts. Nakamichi has already run out of parts for some of the older ones and will not accept these models for factory repair any longer, much less send you parts. Tape. Well, now we go to the slides. Each track of a stereo audio cassette is 1/10 the width of a full track 1/4-inch reel-to-reel analog tape. This is the reel-to-reel tape, and these are the various track configurations. Now, first of all, the width is 1/4 inch. the audio cassette. 60% of it. Let's see if I can get this so that you can get an equal picture here. You can see the 2/10 or 2/100 of an inch is the width of the 8-track over there, and the same width of the tracks, each track of a of an audio cassette in stereo. The cassette speed is 1/8 that of 15 IPS, the high quality but not the highest for reel-to-reel tape. Though thinner tape gives better head wrap, the tape is much more fragile. The C60 base is 1/3 that of normal 1.5 mil rate. Tape. The C90 is 1/4 the thickness, and that of the C120 is 1/6 that thickness. Combining the increased thinness and lesser width makes the tape considerably more subject to twisting, stretching, shouting, wrinkling, and other physical deformation woes. For these reasons, the cassette is the analog champion of data compression. Other ills include reduced bandwidth. The slower the tape speed, the thinner the head gap has to be to record high frequencies onto the tape. At 1 7/8 playing speed, we're pretty close to the limits of precision machining and metallurgy to achieve a 10,000 cycle top. If frequency range matters, don't buy a cheap recorder. And don't use cheap tape on it either. It can work like sandpaper and wear open that gap. In addition, the smaller area of the tape which holds the desired signal has to be amplified more than if it covered a greater area. Amplifiers also generate their own noise, which masks portions of the desired signal without having to turn the volume control all the way up. There's a certain amount of hiss inherent in any tape formulation as well, not to mention friction. Use Dolby. DBX on tape is pretty well phased out now. And be sure to mark that you use Dolby on the cassette label. Another distressing feature of the cassette is the increase in wow, a once per idler wheel turn, and flutter, a regular but pronounced pitch wave, or watery sound on a sustained piano note, for instance, which can come from a worn bearing, for example. The slower the recording speed, the more pronounced these mechanical distortions become. A good cassette recorder has bench specs at about 0.08 wow and flutter. 0.08% wow and flutter. A pro reel-to-reel will deliver 0.35% at 15 IPS, 0.55 at 7.5, as opposed to the 0.08. There should be a zero in front of those two. These figures will increase, sometimes double, each time an analog copy is made. And that's one of the great advantages of digital. It has no wow or flutter. Dirt in the tape path increases these figures rapidly, and more so at slow speeds. Torque problems occur as the weight of the tape pack shifts from one side to the other, especially on thin tape, since the total weight of the tape inside the cassette is greater. This causes speed changes on recorders with weak motors or bad batteries. The problem cascades when initiated during the recording process. If you decide to copy your cassettes for preservation process, what is the best medium to use? Seems we've visited this question once or twice before in meetings here. Another cassette is a possibility that we really have to look at. There are a number of formulations for tapes sold inside the audio cassette, though Audio Magazine and Consumer Reports, among others, have published periodic articles and tests about all of them, none ever focused on the long term. Even the iron oxide formulas are quite different from their brethren, made for the big machines, so you can't use the big boys' test to generate data for the smaller, thinner medium. Lubricants are not identical, as the speed, head wrap, and friction factors are all different. In general, these and their cobalt-modified cousins should age about equally well. I'd be careful of medical particle tapes, which include those used in the digital audio tape. Their chemistry is radically different and have exhibited many interchange problems even when new. The best descriptive word for these is flaky. Many of the clues which allow us to visually diagnose reel-to-reel tape are hidden inside that black shell. If anything sounds strange during playback, stop the machine, take the cassette out, and inspect the portion of the tape that shows through those cassettes' little slots or windows. Make notes. They'll help when you talk with your expert. Describe the sound and tell him what the tape looked like when the problem occurred. But be sure to clean your machine thoroughly before playing these old tapes. And after. Heat damage may affect the tape, but more often it misshapes the shell. The best solution is to remove the tape and put it inside a new shell. And your handout has some guidelines for that. Badly manufactured tape, whose dimensions vary from the standards, whose slitting did not create parallel edges, or which distributed the binder unevenly, are a serious headache. Send that tape to a specialist. Tapes in disasters and which have suffered water damage may have missing pads, missing parts, etc. A cassette transplant is prescribed. As with reel-to-reel, the tape must be cleaned and dried before copying. There is a growing literature on disaster recovery of audio carriers. Check with the Library of Congress and the National Archives. Sticky shed, the disease which afflicts so many reel-to-reel tapes, is seldom found on cassettes. The formulations are different enough, and the product must be so price competitive that the fancy materials which cause so many difficulties on the big reels were not used in making most of the more inexpensive products. Short of inadvertent treatment with peanut butter and jelly, the causes of sticky shed syndromes on audio cassettes are usually traced to other factors. Before copying, always prepare the tape so it will run smoothly and in one pass if possible. Use a cold iron on wrinkled tape after be sure the iron has been demagnetized. If the tape has edge damage, play wind it and store it for a 3-month minimum. Plastic-based tape will revert to the flatness it had when it was new. It will follow its own memory and revert to its original physical configuration if you allow it to. Use more time for thicker tapes. If the improvement isn't complete, play wind as before and store it for another similar period. It's astonishing how well this low-tech process works, but it can't be hurried. Cassettes are the least expensive audio media. If it's this or nothing, then it's this. It has the virtue of being a widely installed technology. Its familiarity and simplicity of operation at the minimal level helps give the cassette the ease and universality of a box camera. The machines are relatively easily repaired, provided parts remain available. Most electronics maintenance folk have experience with the innards of these devices worldwide and know where the line between practical and impossible repair is in their corner of the world. Its drawbacks include the exaggerated buildup of additional wow and flutter and accumulation of background noise each generation. Many machine parts are belt controlled. Soft parts, brakes, belts, rubber wheels, etc., will harden, rot, or stretch, and will probably not be available for your model when the preservation copies are to be played back, though somewhere in some hock shop there will be a working cassette player. If you do use the audio cassette for your next generation of audio preservation, at least be sure the tape hasn't been stopped and started during its last play before it enters storage. If so, rewind it and run it back again at regular playing speed, not in fast forward. This will keep the wind of the tape pack as flat as possible, very important with such fragile, stretchable, thin plastic bases. Rippled edges cause a great deal of trouble, especially on such small and narrow tapes. Every time you use even a portion of the tape in the future, rewind and play wind it again. Don't shirk this. It's the cheapest and best insurance you can give your copy. Put it in its box and store it on edge, perhaps in a 3x5 file drawer. Do not stack them vertically. The bottom cassettes may warp from the weight. Put it into as stable an environment as you can find. The 65 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 to 50% relative humidity is still advised for this. It also has the practical aspects of not requiring you to build a building that will also double as a refrigerator. And once it is ready to be put away, handle it as little as possible. If the content is of great value to you, make two preservation copies which can be run simultaneously. The tape is cheap enough, and store them in two separate places. Reasonable expectations for cassette longevity is probably 15 to 25 years if left alone in a proper and stable storage environment, and it is allowed to acclimatize after being moved to an environmentally benign playback area. Other choices. The best solution is still reel-to-reel, so long as a good tape is available. My second choice would be the gold CDR, provided it is recorded all at once. This means that index points, etc., must be pre-programmed, and probably the best way to do this is to make a DAT or run it through an appropriate program onto a hard drive designed for this use, index it, make sure that the time fits the length of the CD, and make the CDR from that. With spoken word material, you might want to add an index point per minute by hand. No one seems to make a machine to do this yet, but it is badly needed. So it can be coordinated to a transcript, should there be one. Just because the original was inexpensive, it doesn't mean that preserving it will be as well. There's a complex world inside that little plastic box, a medium pushed to near its maximum capabilities whenever it operates. Given knowledgeable, unhurried care, a great deal can be saved. Don't cheap out and destroy the quality of your archive in the process. Be prepared for the engineer who does this work to apply his skills with the same attention he devotes to other media and to have to charge accordingly. His first consideration is to get the best possible sound from the carrier, regardless how much the carrier originally cost. A great deal of the original quality can be rescued during the transfer process. Low budgets lead to low expectations and satisfaction with bad work. Decide what is important to you, your organization's future, and the level of quality that makes the expenditure worthwhile. Find the money so the expert can at least give you samples of what can be achieved under proper studio conditions. Have him inspect the collection and pick out those tapes representative of your problems, batch by batch, rather than make a random sample. He can work up a rough budget once he is at least somewhat familiar with the materials and their quantities. Once the budget arrives, that's the time to panic. Of course, the real solution is to have a regular replacement policy so copies are made while the tapes are still performing properly. And I hope I've been able to persuade you to do just that. Thank you. Jerry, how much time do we have for questions?
About 5 minutes.
All right. We have 5 minutes of questions.
As far as cassettes go, in your view, is there a perfect or ultimate tape shell combination to use for storing things long term? I mean, it's like BASF and Shape One combination, or is there, does Maxell provide something?
The question is, what is the ideal shell combination?
The answer is, I knew the answer to that question until I asked some other people about it. There seems to be so much variation that I simply don't know how to respond so that you're not misguided. My suspicion is that the more expensive tapes will have the better shells. Even the basic question is whether they should be the kind that screw together or the kind that are tack welded. I used to think that the screwing them together was the way to go. Now I've been told that because of the way the machines are operated, the tensions are uneven and those warp more readily than those which are tack welded. So I really don't know the answer. This is the first exploration, as far as I know, of the cassette technology given any serious long-term look anywhere. Michael.
One other thing that people should remember is that you're not always dealing with regularly commercially available cassettes, and quite often you have no idea what's inside those sets.
That's true. The bulk loading is another trap. Anybody else have comment on this? If not, has anybody thought of any more embarrassing questions to ask about the first presentation? If not, then we will take a break. Thank you.